Welcome to Found at TU, where we talk with University of Tulsa faculty about their research, how they do it, why they love it, and what they are finding out. I'm Jolie Jensen, Hazel Rogers Professor of Media Studies at the University of Tulsa. And today we're here with Dr. Adrienne Brochet, Warren Clinic Associate Professor of Sports Administration. Welcome to Found at TU, Adrienne.
Thank you for having me, Jolie.
Oh, glad to have you here. We always begin with the same question, which is, can you tell me in a simple sentence who you are and what you study?
Well, like you said, my name is Adrienne Brochet. I study, I guess, at the intersection of sport, commerce, and culture. I study sort of how American life intersects with all those three topics.
Wow. How'd you get interested in that topic, in those intersections?
Well, I guess I've always been interested in sports, like a lot of young people in this country. I grew up in a sports-related environment. I went to college and played college football as a not very talented player. And then I think when I graduated from college, I said, okay, I have to make a living. How do I want to make a living? It turns out that I wanted to make my living in sports. I spent about 15 years working in Major League Baseball, the National Football League, and at Division I college athletic departments kind of across the country. And that led me to, in those positions, mostly sales and marketing positions. And that led me to eventually want to go back and get further education. So I went back and got, I went back to school at Purdue University, Arizona State, and finally finished my PhD at Texas A&M.
In sports administration?
No, actually, I got my, when I was at Purdue, I studied business. And both at Arizona State and Texas A&M, I studied more educational policy. But it was educational policy based on the sport programs at the university. So I kind of look at it from a little different angle.
Right. What a wonderful combination. You must be kind of unusual in the field, are you,
with that broad background? I am. Our field does have PhDs in sport management. But I had spent about 15 years in sport management. So I kind of wanted to do something a little, come at it from a little bit different angle and study athletic departments through a prism of educational policy, which is how I got to where I'm at.
Great. Great. So now, what would you say right now is your most interesting? I know you have several research areas, so why don't you tell us about those, and then we'll follow up one by one.
Well, I guess I say, you know, probably the most interesting thing I do, and probably what I'm well known for, I guess, is studying escalation within college athletics. Not so much why do colleges play sports, but why do they escalate the spending in colleges? This got started in 2010. I got a grant from the Knight Foundation, which is a famous foundation based out of Miami, Florida, that does a lot of study in educations. They put together a Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics, which still exists to this day, that's comprised of a lot of very famous college presidents, professors, and such. They gave out a grant, and Tulsa was one of five schools, including the University of Virginia, University of Washington, Seattle, University of Texas, I believe, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and the University of Tulsa were five institutions that were awarded this grant. My grant was to specifically look at schools that had escalated spending or look at schools that had quit, look at schools that were where football, just mostly football, you know, it just got too rich for their blood, so to speak. So they had shut down their football programs.
Can you give us a quick sketch of what you
found? Sure. A colleague of mine who was at the University of Memphis, he and I did a report on, we looked at, it was a qualitative piece where we looked at about 20, 25 schools that had dropped their football programs, you know, within the last 20 or 25 years. So we wanted to find out why did they do it and how did they do it.
And what the consequences were.
And what the consequences were. The why was pretty easy to figure out. They did it because it just got to where they just could not afford it.
Right.
Division I, which is the highest level of classification was in the NCAA, and which is really a commercial product. These schools just simply could not afford to. That's something that we all know. Very few schools actually do something about it. So we looked at the schools that did do something about it, and we say, how did they pull it off? And our findings were twofold. Number one, they did not have a lot of money invested in facilities. In other words, their football stadium was old, or maybe they played off campus. My point is, when a school invests a lot of money in facilities,
they're not going to let it go.
They're not going to let it go, mainly because there's usually a donor name associated to that. You can imagine if the University of Tulsa ever wanted to do something with football, you're going to have to explain to the two people that have their name on that stadium why they're dropping football. So we found that the schools that did were able to get away with it had kind of older stadiums. They had not invested in facilities so much. We also look at it as they had pretty courageous presidents who were not scared to take a stand and more take up for the educational side of the institution, unfortunately, they almost always lost their jobs. It might not have been right then and there, but when we talked to them, why did you leave the university? It all came back to because the bad
blowback.
Even though it might have been a couple years later.
Are you considering a longitudinal study to see how those schools are doing 10 years down the pike? Or?
Well, it's funny. You know, most of them stuck with it. I will say East Tennessee State University, which is one we studied, they did announce they were picking it back up. The trend these days is for these schools to actually add football. You see schools like University of North Carolina, Charlotte, Georgia State, schools that I used to say were commuter schools.
Yeah.
They have picked up football programs in the last 5 or 6 years.
In spite of the escalating cost.
In spite of the cost. They say it adds something to the community, to the academic community. Maybe that's true, but it certainly adds a lot of money to student fees. So, that's just something they have to grapple with. A lot of students are quick to vote it. Most of the schools that pick up football say, well, we did a referendum of the students. But the students typically, a lot of times, they don't pay. And if they do, they're going to be gone in a couple of years. So, nobody seems to be on the hook for the cost except the down-the-road students.
Right. And so, what I'm hearing is that your research is attempting to understand the many factors into people keeping on something that on its face doesn't make economic sense.
Sure.
But you're saying it makes a social sense? Or can you say more about what kind of logic would make a university whose mission is education keep a very expensive football team?
Well, let's look at it this way. When we were doing our research, we talked to a lot of different higher education administrators. And I'll never forget the chancellor at Purdue University saying that, Purdue plays in the Big Ten, which is the oldest and most prestigious conference in the country. It's the Ohio State, Michigan Conference, those type schools. And he said, but our alumni don't really care about athletics. They want us to be competitive. Purdue's got a long tradition being really good in basketball, not so much in football. But they have a huge engineering tradition. Everybody that knows Purdue University, mm-hmm. and I went to school there, they have a long tradition of having all their engineering programs in the top 10 or 20 programs in the world. The president said, it's easy to recruit students to this school by telling them that. But your school, I went to undergrad at Auburn University, which is a member of the Southeastern Conference, and those are mostly large southern state schools whose academics are good, but they're certainly not nationally or world-ranked universities. So the chancellor at Purdue said, your schools, you don't have that. You have to talk someone into coming and spending 4 years in Starkville, Mississippi, or Tuscaloosa, Alabama, or Auburn, Alabama. And I've always thought about that quote. It makes a lot of sense, right? Nobody's going to go to Tuscaloosa, Alabama and spend 4 years of college if they did not have the Crimson Tide football program, which leads the whole social atmosphere of that school. Alabama has strong fraternities and sororities, but those fraternities and sororities would not be that strong if it wasn't for college athletics. So everything at those big SEC schools, for the most part, I know we're making some generalizations, Texas A&M and Florida and Missouri and Vandy would say, hey, wait, we are AAU schools, and that's correct. But for
AAU
meaning the top tier university in the United States.
Okay.
The top 60 schools.
So they're saying we do it on education and sports.
Yes, and they're right. They do get away with it. But the other Southeastern Conference schools, I really think having Division I athletics is their drawing card. I'm not saying they don't have great academics or they don't have solid academics. To the mission statement of the school, I went to Auburn University undergrad. It's a land-grant school that is there to educate the students of Alabama. But in order for them to really kind of balance their books, they have to have out-of-state tuition. And what brings that out-of-state tuition to Auburn is college athletics. The problem is not at that level because those schools, while they have massive spending in college athletics, they have massive TV media contracts. They're okay. It's when the schools like the University of Tulsa, when North Texas, when TCU, Rice, when those schools try to compete, that's when the trouble starts. That's the escalation. It's not at the top level because while those coaches make a lot of money, those schools bring in a lot of money. The problem is when schools like the University of Tulsa spend a lot of money on a coaching contract and they don't bring in the revenue that the big schools bring in.
Right. And so that's where the escalation comes in. Maybe if we put more money into it, we can reach that balance point. That
yeah, right.
Hope,
it's right. 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 The when we got the grant from the Knight Foundation, the example that my co-author and I came up with is the coyote chasing the roadrunner, right? It's natural to chase a roadrunner, but after a certain point in time, you think you would give up and try something else because you never seem to catch him. That's what we started our academic paper with, and people always remember it as the roadrunner paper, right? It's not that the coyote chases the roadrunner, because that's expected, but at some point, after years of non-productive behavior, you think the coyote would move on to something else.
Right.
So that's kind of – that's where it's at. The escalation comes with not the, the top-tier schools, but that next tier that try to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak.
Right. And basing on reputation, and it has to do with some non-quantifiable issues and some hopes, right? I mean, it sounds very much like that culture part that you're talking about, with the commerce, sports, and culture. That's the cultural part.
Sure. Right? The you know, I had a colleague told me one time, he said it's really – a remembrance back to old days, right? That's really what drives college athletics. And I'll give
nostalgia.
Nostalgia. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you a great example. When I interviewed here, I met with Roger Blaze, who was the provost. This was in 2009. Mm-hmm. And he said, I was a sport management professor. And, you know, Roger was not a huge sport fan, but he understood. And he said, you know what? I'll never forget the time that Tulsa went to the University of Arkansas and beat the Razorbacks in Fayetteville. That was such a big deal for our campus. And I later looked that up, and it was in like 1977. You know, it had been 35 years ago, but it's
running on fumes.
Running on. So it's really it's hanging on to anomalies is what is kind of what drives it, right? Hanging on to anomalies.
Okay, so that's an example then of your research on college athletics,
right,
and the money and culture connections.
Sure,
can
sure.
you give us another example of another stream of research or in that vein?
Well, sure. I do some research. I got a grant from the Center for Global Ed at the University of Tulsa to go over to Germany and study why the trend in German sports is for corporations to start buying up the soccer teams. You know, that's not the way North America does it. In North America, you know, let's take the city of Atlanta. You know, it's got Delta Airlines, it's got Home Depot, it's got Coca-Cola, it's got a lot of Fortune 500 companies, but they don't own the Atlanta Falcons or the Atlanta Braves or the Atlanta Hawks.
As a business.
As a business, yeah, right? They might go to the games, they might buy a suite, but they don't own a piece of the business. In Germany, one of the trends is for the businesses to actually purchase equity shares in the soccer teams.
Wow.
Just maybe 4 or 5 months ago, Daimler, which is the parent company of Mercedes-Benz, bought a pretty big percent of Stuttgart, which is the local football club, local soccer club, that's actually based right across the street. So why would a automobile manufacturer, Mercedes-Benz, who's one of the top corporations in the world when it comes to producing automobiles, why would they buy equity percent of a soccer team? Not give it money for sponsorship
not
purposes.
Not just branding.
Branding, but right. Why would they purchase it? So Brian Walkup, who's a finance professor at Tulsa, he and I went over there and did some qualitative research on why, you know, what is actually going on there. And what we found out was, you know, these are deeply embedded relationships between the football club and the company. We started out by talking about the city of Atlanta. Well, the Atlanta Braves have really only been in Atlanta since maybe the mid-60s. And I don't know how long Delta Airlines has been around. It's been a while, but Home Depot's only been a company for maybe 35 years. But these relationships between the football clubs in Germany and the corporations go back hundreds of years.
Huh.
So they have a much deeper relationship than perhaps our.
But it still must be a business decision.
It's a business decision. And they were quick to say it's a business decision, but it's not a financial decision. Meaning that the benefits we're going to get, Mercedes-Benz has to invest money in something. They've got money in the bank. There's probably better things they could do for a return on investment. But it's certainly a business decision. And the fact that the people of Stuttgart, they look at this football team. They love this top-ranked football team they have. And they love Mercedes-Benz. And they love the fact that Mercedes-Benz is going to step up and help the local football team do well. So it's a little bit of goodwill.
Yeah.
We found that there's another car company called Audi, which has a parent company called Volkswagen. Audi has purchased equity shares in two Bundesligas, which is the name of the German soccer league. One of them is called Ingolstadt. And Audi said that when we asked them, why would you buy up equity shares in Ingolstadt, which is a good but not great soccer team, they said, well, we have workers in this company, and we need to attract great engineers for us to be a great automobile manufacturer. We have to have great engineers coming to this town. Volkswagen also owns 100% of Wolfsburg, which is another soccer team. And they said, there's nothing to do in Wolfsburg. There's nothing to do in Ingolstadt. So we have to make it's a quality
make
of life.
Attractive.
We have to make it's a quality of life thing. We want all these skilled engineers and their families to come here and be happy. And so, that's something that we just really never thought about, but it makes pretty good sense.
Do you see that then as something that could happen here?
No, I don't.
Why not?
Well, one reason, because these German soccer teams can't move. In other words, if the football team in Stuttgart is not doing very well, it's not going to move to another city. That's not true in the United States. The way a lot of owners make money is by moving sports teams. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine the backlash if Coca-Cola owned the Atlanta Braves and the Atlanta Braves moved to another city. There'd be a lot of backlash on Coca-Cola. So no, it's not. It's a different model of sport. Because of the mobility issue that we have here. I have some baseball research. Again, through another grant I received at the University of Tulsa, I went down to the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico and looked at some of the issues that Major League Baseball has in recruiting talent. Maybe 25% of the players in organized baseball, and that's Major League Baseball and then Minor League Baseball. About 25% of them come from the Latin American countries. So I went down to those two countries and looked at these baseball academies. For instance, we use the Atlanta Braves as an example. The Atlanta Braves have a training academy in the Dominican Republic where they train Dominican Republic kids in playing baseball. And they bring them through the system starting at age 14, 15. They train them 16, 17. And then once they get to be 18, if they're good enough, the Atlanta Braves will bring them over here and put them in their minor league system. But there's been a lot of problems with that. When companies, which the Atlanta Braves is a corporation, when they start getting 14- and 15-year-old kids, there's a lot of labor laws that we have in this country that the Dominican Republic doesn't necessarily have. So there's been a lot of issues with Major League Baseball and how some of the teams have acted towards these Latin American players who are often tremendously uneducated about what they're getting themselves into.
So it's a question about exploitation.
So it's a question of exploitation. When I was down there, I ran into a professor at Harvard Law School who was also doing research, and he said, you know, the bottom line is we would never put up with this happening to American kids. And if we would never put up with it, then we shouldn't be doing it that way. I will say this. Major League Baseball has done a good job of trying to correct the problem. And the problems are immense. It's not nearly as easy as some people make it sound. Education is not a priority down there, even in the best of circumstances. So Major League Baseball has done a pretty good job over the last 7 or 8 years trying to correct the problem and invest in nice academies that they have, and they've done a pretty decent job.
You've mentioned qualitative research, so sure. I want to hear more about what that's like for the people who aren't familiar with qualitative and quantitative research. But I also want to ask about how it is that your work is making changes. I mean, the example you just gave is a good one. So let's go to both those places if we can.
Well,
qualitative research first.
I got interested in qualitative research mainly because a lot of my colleagues in the business school, they do quantitative research.
In other words, they're counting and they're using statistics and data analysis of things that can be.
A lot of times they're using what we call secondary data. I've got a colleague that studies the airline industry, which is one of the most regulated industries around. Most airlines are publicly traded, so you can get access to their financials. Sports doesn't have that. Almost all of our sports teams at the professional level are what's called closely held companies, meaning they're not telling you how much money they're making or losing. Also, from a research standpoint, one of my advantages was I spent 15 years in the field, so I had a lot of friends in the field.
Sure.
So I could call these friends and they're not going to give me their financials. That would be perhaps risking their jobs, but they are going to give me an interview. So I had some insight into how these teams work because I had some people that I knew that could give me some insight.
So qualitative research is based on interviews, interpretations. You're interpreting interpretations, basically.
You're interpreting interpretations. And that's tricky. You know, you have to kind of watch out. I mean, when you ask somebody a question, maybe they're just giving you the answer that you want to hear. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of, make sure you're maintaining some what quantitative we'll call validity.
Right.
But qualitative research to me is tremendously interesting. I like going into a sports organization, talking to the people in the know and having them tell me what's going on. It's not just interviews. It's looking at some archival data, artifacts. When I was in the Dominican Republic, I actually went to the baseball games and saw the kids and talked to them and that sort of stuff. So I enjoy doing qualitative research, but it's tremendously time consuming. You know, you have to make a little trade-off on I'm going to spend all this time doing this qualitative research when I could be just doing quantitative, which is just more quickly doing research.
Right.
I do a combination of it mainly because I happen to befriend some people at the University of Tulsa who were really, really good at the quantitative side of it. They were finance professors that had kind of grown up in that method. And if I can bring my expertise and their sort of data analytics expertise, then we could produce some good stuff.
That collaboration
caused a bunch of really good research to get done.
Well, I can hear the enthusiasm in your voice. It's obviously you love doing research. So part of it is just the intrinsic, it seems to me, enjoyment of it. I assume it's also rewarding to have your research make a difference, make changes or shift things. Do you feel like your findings are having an impact?
Yeah, I guess, you know, what does having an impact mean and what does making changes mean? Those are great questions. If we were to go back to the original Knight Foundation grant that I spoke about early, that was in 2010. It took us a couple years to collect that data. We presented that data at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., in front of reporters from the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, and ESPN. And that research was heavily covered by the media.
It
was
accurately?
Accurately.
Good.
It was on the cover. Again, but you know, it's funny. The takeaway from all of it was the Roadrunner story, which I learned a lesson.
The power of a good story.
The power of a good story, which is something that you knew that Adrian had no idea. But we came up with that story. It was impactful in the fact that it was on the cover of ESPN.com. It got heavily covered. Did it change anything? I don't know. Maybe you're chipping away at the stone a little bit. I mean, maybe you're changing. I mean, if it's on the cover of ESPN.com, a lot of people are reading it. So can you quantify that change? I don't know about that. But at the same time, you can help influence the public's perception of what's going on. And maybe that's
based on real evidence.
Based on real evidence. I mean, these were, you know, we spent 2 years collecting this data from people, from higher education administrators that had made this choice. So it was based on absolutely real evidence, and we told the positives and the negatives of what happened to them.
Again, I feel like your research really represents one of the wonderful things about academic research is you can, without fear or favor, I mean, can you say a little bit more about kind of the ethics that guide your research? Because you're doing controversial things in an area that's full of anecdote, full of opinion, right?
Yeah. There is a lot of maybe controversy around kind of what I do. I'm lucky I'm tenured at the University of Tulsa. So that gives me a little bit of protection, as it does a lot of faculty members that are tenured. But that research took place before that. So you have to make a decision. I mean, if your goal in life as an academic researcher is to be popular at the country club, then you're not going to get there doing the research I do. I mean, when you go in front of the National Press Club and talk about how athletic departments are off the rails, believe me, it's not going to win you a lot of friends. That said, I've got a lot of friends that are athletic directors, and they, you know, privately they said, hey, what you did was great. Publicly, we would never acknowledge it. So it's more one of those things. I think they respect it. And I'm always good for a good argument. I mean, if they want to take the time to collect evidence and argue the other direction, I would love to hear it.
Again,
I'm open.
We believe academic life is about evidence and evidence speaking, not just throwing off opinions, right?
My field's a little different because it seems like students, what they hear is talk radio. What they hear is ESPN. What they hear about the World Cup is Fox. And I try to tell my students, look, those are cheerleaders for the sports business. They're in bed with the sports industry.
Nicely said.
I'm not saying they're lying, but I'm telling you they're shading it from their perspective.
Mm-hmm. You know? They're spinning it.
Spinning it. I was watching the World Cup, and the announcer said, this has been the greatest World Cup in the history of soccer. Okay. I mean, how did you – is that just something you're saying, or can you show me a little proof that it's better than the one 4 years ago? Because I have a feeling 4 years ago you'd have said the same thing. So I try to get the students to, look, I love sports. It's been my life.
Right.
But let's don't look at it through rose-colored glasses. Let's understand that the TV networks are really embedded with the professional leagues and the colleges as well.
As a commercial product.
As a commercial product. Yeah. As a commercial product.
Can you say more about what the costs and benefits are of that? Especially, let's go back to your first area of research in an educational setting, for example. What are the challenges?
Well, if we do the cost and benefits of college athletics, there is no doubt in my mind that, well, let me give you a story. My best friend in Birmingham, Alabama, I grew up with three or four guys. We were really close. One of them went to the University of Tennessee. One of them went to the University of Alabama. I went to Auburn. Actually, two of them went to the University of Alabama. And now we're at that age where our kids are going to school. And their kids are going to the University of Alabama, which is a very good state school. But they were complaining to me not too long ago about the cost. And I said, well, Chris, why are you sending me to University of Alabama? You live in this great house in the suburb of Birmingham. Your son could go to University of Alabama, Birmingham, which is a more of a commuter school, and he could major in accounting there. You don't have to send him down to Alabama. I said, why do you send him down to Alabama? The bottom line is you send him down to Alabama for the social aspects of it, okay? Mm-hmm. And that is college football in the state I grew up in. That's all about college football. So there are tremendous benefits from college athletics. It does a great job of getting kids to come to your campus. It does a wonderful job of getting out-of-state kids to come to your campus, in which case your school can charge double the price, okay?
Right.
So, and it also does a good job to maintain alumni ties. My father, till the day he died, had season tickets to Auburn University.
Mm-hmm.
56 years from the time he graduated Auburn, he had tickets. That tied him to Auburn. My family grew up driving down to Auburn games every Saturday, and it was no surprise when it came time for me and my brothers to go to school that we were going to Auburn. So college athletics does wonderful benefits for universities. On the flip side, there comes a time when you have to sit there and say, well, we'll use the university we're at right now because we know the University of Tulsa. Does the University of Tulsa get those benefits the way that University of Arkansas, Oklahoma State do? I doubt that's true. We're a private mm-hmm. school. It costs us more to operate. We do not necessarily survive on out-of-state tuition. We survive on out-of-country tuition. And I don't think anybody from Beijing, China is saying, I'm coming to Tulsa because they play in the American Conference.
Right.
The problems are is that you have an athletic director and a college president who have absolutely no incentive to slow this down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you had our athletic director and he went to the president saying, look, Division I is kind of passed Tulsa by.
Mm-hmm.
He is killing himself, right? He is never going to get another athletic directorship in Division I sports.
Mm-hmm.
If he's here when they drop football, he's never going to. It'll kill his career. It would kill the president's career. Remember, we did research at some lower-level state schools on why they dropped football. The president lost a job every single time. So it's in nobody's interest to slow it down. Unfortunately, that's kind of the structure in higher education.
Nobody's immediate interest. It may be in a number of people's long-term future.
Sure. There's no immediate interest. Mm-hmm. So at what point is it just counterproductive? I think the faculty and the students at the University of Tulsa have seen that in the last 2 years. When you have a president saying, we're cutting retirement from faculty and staff, and one of the main reasons we're doing it
for
is
budgetary
for budgetary reasons, but one of the reasons we're doing it is for athletics. I mean, mm-hmm. the president said this to us when we met with him. Boy, I mean, at some point you might want to sit there and say, somebody needs to take a stand. You would hope that the Board of Trustees would err on the side of the education aspects of it.
Well, that's what's so exciting to me about your research is it doesn't do it for invective or opinion or off the cuff.
Sure.
You have the evidence. You've done the analysis. We can make a decision, or these kinds of decisions, evidence-based decisions rather than opinion-based decisions. And that's the joy of research, it seems to me.
That said, the Board of Trustees never invited me to.
Yet. They haven't heard this podcast, have they? Oh, Adrian, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I really enjoyed it. I'm Jolie Jensen, and this has been Found It to You, a monthly podcast produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa on the TU campus. We've been talking with Dr. Adrian Boucher, Associate Professor of Sports Administration, about his research into the relationships between sports, commerce, and culture. Please join us next month for another chance to hear a University of Tulsa faculty member discuss, in everyday language, the nature and value of their research.